This episode of the Disney Film Project podcast is brought to you by touringplans.com. It is the one-stop shop on the internet for figuring out how you are going to plan your Disney vacation, Disneyland or Disney World, it doesn't matter. Seven Dwarfs Mine Train, you want to figure out how to get there and not wait in line? This is how you do it, touringplans.com. At Disneyland, you're trying to figure out how to get out there and how to navigate all the cool new stuff like Cars Land and Buena Vista Street and all that great stuff without having to wait in line? Touringplans.com. You can optimize your touring plans, check the crowd calendar, do all kinds of great stuff. Make sure you check that out over at touringplans.com. They're the sponsor of this week's episode of the Disney Film Project podcast. Welcome again, everybody, to the Disney Film Project podcast. This is the show where we talk about the films of the Walt Disney Company, Marvel, Pixar, Disney Toon Studios, in this case, Lucasfilm. We talk about it all here on this program and over at DisneyFilmProject.com. I'm Ryan Kilpatrick, host of the program, and along with the folks you're about to meet, we run DisneyFilmProject.com, where you can find all sorts of Blu-ray and DVD reviews. You can find show notes for this very show. You can find reviews going all the way back to the 1920s, so make sure you go and check out the content that is all there for you at DisneyFilmProject.com. Joining me, as always, I have our fine film experts. First of all, we have Mr. Todd Perlmutter, who is not a sound designer and is not full of strange magic, but he has a lovely singing voice.
Me, 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 me.
See, I told you. Of course, we also have the one and only Miss Rachel Kolb from all sites on the internet. Where can people find you this week, Rachel?
This week, I'm going to be directing them over to ludusnyc.com, also uprocks.com. Over on Ludus, I have a brand new review for a show that's playing here in the city called You on the Moors Now. It's a mashup of famous literary figures from Jane Eyre to Elizabeth Bennet from Pride and Prejudice. It's a really great show. Highly recommend it. And I have a bunch of new stuff over on Uproxx, so definitely check that out too.
Awesome. And, of course, our producer, the person who keeps the trains running on time, who whips us all into shape, edits, which I cannot say enough about and we don't ever give her enough credit for, who makes sure that this show gets released on time, is Miss Cheryl Perlmutter, who you can find on Twitter at CherylP3. How are you, Cheryl?
I'm doing good. I did all my editing for this week already since I'm going to be walking 5K on Friday morning.
All right. Today, tonight, tomorrow, wherever you are listening and whatever time you're listening, you are going to listen to us talk about the Lucasfilm picture newly under the Disney banner because, well, Disney owns it. Strange Magic. And as we do from time to time, we invite friends and countrymen and sometimes Romans to join us to talk about the films that we are going to discuss. So with us, we have from the Genre Savvy podcast, Philip Elke. How are you, Philip?
Very good. Yes, Philip II of Macedon. My dad's also named Philip, so Philip Alexander, yes, is my complete name. Philip Alexander Elke.
There you go. And
yeah, so definitely got the whole, well, it's not ancient Roman, but it's close theme going on. Yeah, Genre Savvy podcast. You can check us out at genresavvy.com. Pleasure to be on.
I was going to say, tell everybody a little bit about your show before we get cranked up here.
Well, yeah, it's just a show about general pop culture, you know, as opposed to soda culture with those pesky Wisconsins, you know, next door.
Sure.
We kind of put our own Northwood spin on things. But yeah, general geek culture. I mean, if you know me, I'm kind of into all things geek and nerd. And, you know, I don't really focus on any one particular genre or, you know, property or franchise. You know, I'm very much omnibus in my consumption of media. So
nice. All right. Great. Well, welcome aboard. As I mentioned today, we're going to be talking about Strange Magic, which was released earlier this year to a underwhelming debut, is the nice way to say it, probably. This is the film that, if you guys listened to the show that we did at the very beginning of the year or towards the end of last year about the upcoming films in 2015. We talked about this movie. It is released by Lucasfilm. It was in production before Disney bought Lucasfilm. It's something that George Lucas has worked on for many, many moons, and was directed by Gary Rydstrom, who was a sound designer with Lucasfilm for quite some time. And the title, Strange Magic, is appropriate, at least the strange part, in that I believe, if I remember correctly, from the four of us who were on the show, that show, and we'll get your take, Philip, none of us really knew what to make of this. When the announcement came out, what, two months before it came out?
November. Yep. It was about 25 to 30 days before it came out.
Yeah.
I did listen to your 2015 overview episode and you heard your insight on it. And yeah, it's I learned about it, you know, as soon as it dropped, you know, the news of its release, and I think it had been hinted as like potential Frozen sequel or something, but no, it ended up being this, you know, brand new animated feature from ILM, kind of a successor to Rango, you know, because they did that film as well, at least Industrial Light and Magic, you know, that was the primary production house responsible for the animation. But yeah, I thought it looked interesting, but the more I learned about it, the more, you know, strange, as the title prophetically elaborates, I wasn't too thrilled about like the whole concept behind it as much, with the musical kind of Mamma Mia-esque conceit.
Right. So for those who have not seen it, which judging by the box office would be the majority of our listeners, it is the concept in general was described as A Midsummer Night's Dream, the Shakespeare play, married with contemporary pop music and set in a world of goblins and elves.
I want to say it's more like Into the Woods than I've never seen Into the Midnight's Dream, but it's a lot like Into the Woods set to music. Except Into the Woods was much better than this was. I'll agree with that one definitely.
Yeah.
But the concept is moving the plot along with song, which worked very well in Into the Woods. I thought it worked well with this. I thought there were parts that were too long, but I thought moving the plot along with song is a good concept.
I'll be honest, I kind of have the exact opposite feeling about that. I feel like they put in these pop songs that people are familiar with to just fill in for any actual substantive dialogue or action that would develop these characters, and relied a bit too much on the fact that people know these songs and like these songs.
Yeah, I think this is a movie where if you take like all the music out of the movie, it's really only about 25 minutes long.
I thought it did a good job, though, with the pop song aesthetic. I mean, for what it was, that's what it was originally designed to be. It was kind of a George Lucas vanity project where he basically picked songs that he liked to listen to while he's on the treadmill and, you know, make a movie out of them.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with jukebox musicals in general. Like, there's a number that I really enjoy. I'm actually a huge fan of Moulin Rouge, which is, you know, one that kind of got compared a lot to this. But the biggest thing between this movie and Moulin Rouge is that Moulin Rouge did something much more with the arrangements of the songs. They were much more original takes on the songs, whereas here they're very straightforward pop renditions of pop songs.
Yeah, I mean, well, Marius de Vries did do this soundtrack as well, because he also did the soundtrack for Moulin Rouge.
Yeah.
So that's part of the reason for the comparisons. But you're right. I mean, there are a few of them that are changed, but honestly, here's my problem. It's like you look at a song like Moulin Rouge, a movie like Moulin Rouge, you look at a movie like Into the Woods, and you look at a movie like, well, I can't say American Graffiti. I'll get to American Graffiti in a minute, though. But both those movies, right, the songs are written for the movie to tell the story of the movie, right?
Yep.
And here, unfortunately, as good as the songs are, one, none of these actors belong singing any of these songs. That's my personal opinion.
I would agree with you on that.
I just thought like none of them really did any of the songs the justice they deserve, and one particular version of one particular song went on a little too long. Actually, I would say two of them. One of them being Come On, Marianne, which the title character is actually named after that song.
Right.
That's the other half of it. That's, you know, crazy when you think about it. But if you look at it like American Graffiti, which is what Lucas was trying to capture here when he was picking these songs and came up with the idea, is American Graffiti, the songs carry moments of the movie when things are going on that don't require dialogue. Right? In here, the songs are going on at points when dialogue is really required.
Yeah, the it feels much more like, you know, Philip mentioned, or was it might have been you, Rachel, that mentioned Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and it, so like in Mamma Mia, like, I don't care for the songs of ABBA, and I actually enjoy the musical because the way, even though the songs are, the musical is built around the songs, there is a story to follow there that the songs are subservient to the story. This feels very much like they had a set of songs that they wanted to make into a movie, and they shoehorned a story around that.
Yeah, the problem is that it's, instead of just doing a jukebox musical, like they could have done a jukebox musical and built a story around that. But the problem is that they also threw in the element of Midsummer Night's Dream and having to fit in that story with it as well. And so you just kind of end up with something that's unsatisfying.
Yeah.
Either way.
Well, Lucas originally wanted an entire
Beatles... I disagree. It was unsatisfying. I was totally satisfied with this movie so much that, like, after we saw it, I'm like, I could go see that again.
You would be the only person in America who did that, just FYI.
Yeah,
I thought twice.
I don't
really,
hate,
really?
I don't hate
okay.
the movie, to be honest, but I have a problem with certain aspects of it. Like, I think it could have been a better movie had certain things gone through differently. That's just kind of sort of my opinion of it.
Absolutely, yeah.
But, like, Lucas originally wanted the entire thing to be a Beatles soundtrack.
Right.
And
but he
could
have that kind of money.
No.
Well, the idea was, it was tossed around that it would be purely singing as well.
There was that, right? It was going to be more like a Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band type of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Which, by the way, is also a very bad movie. Just FYI, if you haven't seen it lately and you hear, oh yeah, Sgt. Pepper's, but it's Sgt. Pepper's with the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton. It's not, the Beatles are not in that movie.
Yeah.
Just FYI.
Yeah. If you want a Beatles movie, just go watch Hard Day's Night. It's the best of the bunch.
but I think part of why it suffers is possibly because it was written with one set of songs in mind and ended up with a whole different set of songs.
Well, I think, like, for me, my first impression after watching it is yes, I agree with that. I think, like you're saying, like we're saying here, though, there's all kinds of stuff trying to happen here, and I think it's just a little too much. Like, there's the Midsummer Night's Dream, the ideas and the moral of the story that they're trying to get across. They're trying to build up a lot of complex character relationships in a very short period of time while also trying to get in these fancy musical numbers. And like it's both complex and simple at the same time, in that there's a ton of ideas they're trying to get across, but they don't really do any of them a lot of justice because they're trying to fit in songs as well. And so at the end, like for me, it left me a little cold because I didn't feel like I knew any of the characters. And I didn't enjoy the music.
Oh, yeah, I totally disagree. I loved it all.
And I have some thoughts about that moral, about the message of the movie, which George Lucas has said in numerous interviews is the message of the movie. I have some thoughts about that and whether that actually backs that up. But we'll get to that once we get into the plot.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, and I also wanted to ask, did any of you read the interview with George Lucas where he talked about this being like Star Wars for his daughters?
I'm sure you love that misogynism. I read that too.
Yeah.
I was like, well, why can't Star Wars be for girls? Why can't girls and boys kind of like the same things? I mean, it's okay. Here's the thing. I'm very happy that he tried to make in my opinion, it fails. Other people enjoyed it. I guess, get that, Cheryl. But for me, it was frustrating to see a movie that's clearly aimed at girls and trying to be an adventure movie that I feel failed in so many ways. And it was frustrating for me to hear Lucas say that this is meant for girls and that adventure movies aren't made for girls, because this is the age of Hunger Games and the age of all these other female-driven properties. And
well, how old of girls are we talking about here?
Well, he said specifically he was aiming this at 12-year-old adolescent girls. And I mean, if there's anyone that has their pulse on what adolescent girls want in their movies, it's clearly George Lucas.
Yeah. Obviously. He had been working on it for 15 years specifically for his daughters.
Yes.
I guess his daughters don't like Star Wars. That's where I'm guessing the whole thing comes from.
Right.
We got to push content, you know. You can't just, you know, yeah, backtrack on the same, you know, franchise.
Yeah. Now, the dialogue, what there is of it, is actually really well written. So I did want to throw credit to Irene Michi, who did write this, and she did, you know, and she's not responsible for the song part of it, obviously. But, you know, she wrote Brave and Hercules and Hunchback and Lion King. You know, she's one of the principals on all of those movies. So
that's what I noticed. The dialogue was very, you know, pithy. It was witty, kind of almost Shakespearean at times, you know, just in how, I don't know, it was pretty hilarious at times, I thought.
Yeah. I think from time to time it's pretty good. I don't think I have as high opinion of it as you guys do, but I don't think the dialogue was the issue with the film, for sure.
Yeah.
That's plenty of laugh out loud. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know we touched on how poorly this movie has made money. I mean, this movie hasn't even made back 20% of what it cost to make, not even, let alone advertising.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, for what advertising they did. I mean, yeah. I think you got the sense, and we talked about this in the preview show, that Disney saw this and just wanted to get it out.
Yeah.
You know,
there was actually an interview with, it was Elijah Kelly, and who's one of the actors in the movie, and George Lucas. And the interviewer asked him, you know, I just heard about this movie a month ago. What happened here? Like, you know, why haven't you guys done as, like, aggressive of marketing on this? And he got extremely defensive about it and said, well, you know, we're not so much worried about marketing and stuff and advertising. We just want to make a good movie. Yeah. To which anyone that's followed anything Star Wars, you know, back to the prequels and the aggressive advertising from episode one, I don't quite buy that.
Well, yeah. The original Star Wars relied a lot on that word of mouth appeal, because that only saw a release initially in, you know, a handful of theaters. It would eventually get a wide release from Fox, but yeah, clearly with George Lucas's intent that this be kind of a new Star Wars type franchise, it did not work out that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it opened in 3,000 theaters and only made $5.5 million. So that's about $1,200 per theater. That's really not good money at all.
Yeah, it's the lowest opening for an animated film in, you know, 3,000 plus screens. But of course, it was hardly advertised at all. So I'm not really surprised it got such a poor reception at first. But that it didn't, you know, go anywhere from there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you guys on the lack of advertising. I mean, and this is stuff we pay attention to. Like, the people listening to this show and the people, you know, obviously us, like, we look at that stuff and we look for advertisements and how do they market these films and things like that. And I saw nothing.
Okay, I did see stuff, and I didn't like what I saw. I'm gonna say that now.
Same here.
Yeah.
They had a few ads on, like, Bravo, and maybe they had a few on Disney XD that caught. Must have been some of those channels. But I remember catching the scenes, and I'm like, I'm seeing this movie. This is the movie I'm seeing. I'm not really into this movie.
Based on the screenshots, I thought it looked gorgeous, but then, you know, we got this advertising, what little we did get, and there was really no attempt by Disney or Lucasfilm to sell us on the concept. I mean, it was just these wacky trailers and TV spots and really nothing to alleviate what I call the WTF factor, you know.
And you're right. It is an absolutely stunningly beautiful movie to look at. Like, if you put this thing on mute and you could watch it and it's enjoyable to watch visually.
Right.
You know, it's really good eye candy.
Yeah, I will agree with that, for sure.
Yeah, I just also want to say I spent $15 on my ticket for a matinee, for a morning matinee for this.
I think there's more to be told on the story of this film behind the scenes, because the fact that Disney, you know, released the information that it was coming out so late, the fact of, like Rachel said, like, even here, you know, in New York, she couldn't get it. Even here in Atlanta, I had to really dig around to find the thing. And that was a week after release, I think, is when I went to see it. So it was definitely – there's definitely something, like, they either – people saw this in advance and didn't like what they saw, or they didn't think it was going to do well or something. But, yeah, this did not – it was hard to find places to see it, and hard to find anything about it until right up on the release, which is not normal for a movie of this size.
That's really weird, because, like – we had no problems finding it here in downtown Disney.
Yeah, well, that doesn't surprise me.
Funny story, you guys. The day that this movie came out, I saw it on a Thursday, like opening release, 8 p.m. But I was the only one in the screening. I went by myself, and literally no one else was there. This was the first showing here in town. And funnily enough, the previous movie I saw was American Sniper, and that was completely full. So I went from an auditorium that was packed to one that was literally empty in two consecutive movie viewings.
I think that's one of the reasons why you didn't see much advertising for this, because I don't know if Lucasfilm really knew how to market this, who the target audience was for this movie. Because the tough thing is that it's clearly, like, the story and the characters are very much aimed at a young audience, but the music, for the most part, is very much throwback music. I mean, some of it I'm sure that they might recognize, but they're not going to have the same sort of connection to it as older audiences.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's one of those movies that I think I will definitely give them credit in that they tried to do something very different, right? It's not like you're not going to see DreamWorks or Pixar or Disney produce a film that is anything like this.
Well,
for good or bad, right? Like, but they tried to do something different, and I think it could have been a huge hit or a massive failure. And I don't know that there was much middle ground there.
Well, yeah. I kind of think they kind of tried to duplicate Shrek.
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah. I think that Black Nerd on YouTube nailed it. I didn't read a whole lot of reviews before seeing the movie or even after it, but he said, if George Lucas was trying to make a DreamWorks movie, which was trying to be a Disney movie, while watching an episode of Glee, this is what you get.
Yeah, because unlike Shrek, I mean, this is a straight musical, but it still uses a lot of, you know, heavy pop culture influences.
Yeah,
and the prince in this movie, well, Roland in this movie just looks like the prince from Shrek 2 with wings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's when I say that, I think they tried to go for it. Like, I think they actually tried to create something that was distinct and different from all of those things, but I think where they netted out was drawing on all that stuff because of the fact that they've been working on it for 15 years. All right, so let's talk about the film, because the plot itself, we might be here all night because it's quite complicated. It is, like we said, it's sort of based on A Midsummer Night's Dream, but I think they went pretty far afield from that. So the basic concept that we're introduced to at the opening of the film is that there's two lands in this world. There is a land of fairies and light, and then there's a land of dark with these other, you know, demonic-looking creatures that we find out later is a bog. And the basic border between these lands is the primrose flowers, which grow along the border, and they are the ingredient needed to make a love potion. We're not really told why that's important, or any of those sorts of things. But the first character we get introduced to is Marianne, who's probably the main character of the entire film. She's the main protagonist. And she's a fairy, and she is a princess, and she's engaged to be married. She's flying around singing about how wonderful life is, and she is engaged to be married to Roland, who is, as Rachel said, the prince, the blonde, handsome prince. And the sort of inciting incident of the whole movie is that as she's flying around all happy and carefree, singing about her love is she sees Roland kissing another girl.
On apparently their wedding day.
Correct. Yep. On their wedding day. And she vows that she will never fall in love again, and Marianne goes goth.
Yep. She gets some dark eye makeup, and she goes goth.
Yeah. And apparently learns to sword fight, as we find out later.
Well, she practices. Because there's like three sword fighting practice montages in this movie.
Yeah, true.
I was assuming she just reverted to her usual tomboyish self and, you know, was simply in the wedding, you know, feminine attire for that special occasion. Of course, you saw her try to fashion that boutonniere that ended up looking, you know, like it was, you know, made by the Bog King. But do you remember that?
I do. Yeah. I do.
So she was kind of a tomboy to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I didn't really... I mean, I think that's one of the things that like, for me, is... I did find her character somewhat interesting, but I didn't get much in the way of understanding who she was other than she was scorned by Roland.
Yep.
And that was, like, the primary driving force of her character through the movie. And I think maybe if they had layered some different stuff on there, it could have added to her character.
I don't know. Once she put the armor on, it sold me. I'm kind of a... you know, weapons and armor fetish type guy, so.
There you go. So, yes, Marianne's not the only princess, in the kingdom. She has a sister named Dawn. And Dawn is one of those girls, apparently, who just falls in love with whatever guy she sees. She's boy crazy, for lack of a better term. And there's a spring ball coming up. Apparently, they have a lot of balls, as in festivals. In this kingdom.
Not a pit of balls.
Correct. They do not have a ball pit. No. That is correct.
They could have used some AC/DC in this movie.
I think they could have used a lot of different choices. That's one thing I have to say is it was weird because like at some points they're singing, you know, like Temptations and Four Tops music and Motown, and then they're going back to Beyonce, and then they're going to like classic rock and
Lady
like,
Gaga.
I get it.
Yeah. Marius DeVry said he did that purposely, by the way. If you think about it, the songs each play to where they are in terms of place on the map that we saw in the beginning.
Yes. Right. Yep. I definitely agree with that.
Yep. They absolutely do. But I think for me going – like I adjusted to it in the movie. But like for me going in, the one thing I did see is like that it was all based on like classic rock songs. And so I was expecting that. I was expecting to at least enjoy the rock music, and then all of a sudden I'm getting hit with Sugar Pie Honey Bunch, and I'm going, wait, I. Huh? but yeah, it does. You're right. It does. The music matches the placement on the map and where they are.
Well, and the music is all in universe too. It's not like it's breaking the fourth wall. Like it is acknowledged that they are singing. That's just part of these fairies, you know, culture essentially.
True.
They live their lives through song.
I did think there was a couple of moments where they were singing where it felt like they weren't acknowledging it to a degree. Like there's the point in the upcoming in the ball where she attacks Roland, basically. And
the Kelly Clarkson?
Yeah, where she's singing the Kelly Clarkson song. And I felt like I don't feel like everyone was really acknowledging that was happening.
We got a great uvula shot too, and you know the little thing in the back of your throat—that's what it's called, right?
Right.
Seemed lifted from the special edition of Return of the Jedi. You know, when they're singing in Jabba's palace.
Right.
Yeah, I don't necessarily consider that a good thing.
Yeah, well, there's the George Lucas element for you.
Yep. Which, speaking of George Lucas, the king is clearly George Lucas.
Oh yeah.
Oh, for sure, absolutely.
But they weren't afraid to make fun of him, you know, like he had to be carried around on a palanquin all the time. He could barely fly himself. It was kind of, I don't know, derisive, it seemed at times.
Well, the king is a really weird character because he keeps trying to push Marianne to get together with Roland, even though, and he keeps referring to it as a misunderstanding what happened between the two of them, which, no, that's not an
misunderstanding. Yeah, nothing was misunderstood. Yeah.
I just... it's so weird that he's like not taking his daughter's side in this, and then at the same time he's like shaming her sister Dawn for being so boy crazy. It's such mixed messages that he's sending to his daughters. That
One of the lines I loved from the movie was, "Keep an eye on that flirtatious sister of yours."
Do you think this was intentional, though, right? Because Lucas wrote the movie, the king looks just like him. So obviously he wrote that to be him, and somebody said, we'll just make it look like you then. And he's supposed to be preaching to his own daughter somehow. That's what I gather is supposed to be going on. You know, because he did say he wrote the movie for his daughter, you know, the original plotting for his daughter, so...
Yeah, I don't know. I get the sense, though, that, like we said, you know, this movie's been in development for a long, long time, that there are, as happens with movies like that, like, there are elements from 10 years ago, and there's elements from 6 months ago.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. But back to Dawn. So she has a little elf friend named Sunny, who is helping her to get ready. He is trying to help her, you know, get ready for the spring ball and pick out which boy she's going to flirt with and all this sort of thing. And right as he's trying to help her, a giant lizard comes out of a cave, which I shouldn't say he was giant because he's a normal-sized lizard and they're little tiny fairies.
Yes.
Yep.
And chases them. Marianne comes through and rescues them in her, you know, best Jennifer Lawrence Katniss posing and armor and swords and fighting and such, and, you know, gets mad at the lizard and chases off the lizard and all this sort of thing. But Sunny, the elf, actually falls through the border to the dark forest, and when he does that, he finds a primrose petal, which is apparently a big deal, and he, you know, manages to scramble back over the border, but he hides the primrose petal on their side of the border before he, you know, chases back with Dawn and Marianne back to the kingdom. And this is important because later he's going to want to make a love potion because, as we did not just now say, he is in love with Dawn. It's very obvious. He sings about it, you know, as he's trying to help her get ready.
The other thing is that she had dropped her boutonniere that she had been making in the same section after she had almost made into the dark section. So I think that's what they think that she was. They're trying to make a love potion because they saw the primrose wrapper and they saw the boutonniere stuff and they're like, oh, someone's trying to make a love potion.
Yeah,
that's what I thought at the beginning. So I was like, oh wait, you just need the primrose. I didn't realize that part until after.
Cool. And so, like we mentioned at the ball, there is a whole thing going on where Roland shows up still trying to marry Marianne, and she sings Kelly Clarkson to him, Stronger, and how she's better than him and she can take care of herself and she doesn't need him and all this kind of stuff, and basically knocks him out of the dance and, you know, kicks him around. And Roland encounters Sunny outside the dance, who is, you know, distraught because Dawn's inside flirting with everything in sight. And Roland convinces Sunny that what they need is a love potion in order to make this happen. And the problem is that the love potion can only be made by the Sugar Plum Fairy, a heretofore unseen and unmentioned character.
Yep.
which was my main problem. It's just so very convoluted in that we're introducing characters without, not by seeing them, but by saying this is a character that's going to have to appear because reasons.
Yeah, I thought that they just needed the petal to make the potion. I thought that they themselves could make the potion. So when they introduced the whole thing of the fairy, it wasn't until he was actually going into the forest and everything that I realized, oh, he can't actually do it himself. He's tracking down someone to do it for him.
Well, he's right. Just an elf anyway, so.
True. But anyway, he has to go to the Sugar Plum Fairy, who is imprisoned by the Bog King, who we also don't necessarily know, and get her to create the love potion. Right? Everybody follow that?
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, at this point in the movie, he's been introduced in shadow, the Bog King. We just haven't seen him in full view yet.
Correct.
Yeah.
All right. So, Sunny goes back to the petal that he hid, gets met by the little white mouse-looking character, which I guess is an imp.
Imp. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. This was the one I saw in all of the various and sundry promotion that I did see.
Yep.
No, the thing's in the movie for a good 20 minutes, and then you find out what it's actually called.
I suppose Imp works, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, that's what it's called. It's mm-hmm. Imp. It's Imp because it's a Sugar Plum Fairy says don't let the Imp anywhere near the potion.
No, it's later established, but I mean, what else would you call it? It doesn't really look like any natural, you know, creature.
Neither does anything else in the bog.
Yeah, true. True statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, considering that it's basically the Agent of Chaos and that this is based on Midsummer Night's Dream, it's clear that it's supposed to be Puck.
Yeah.
But apparently they didn't want to call it Puck.
And so in they go, and Sunny goes into the Dark Forest, manages to find his way into the Bog King's castle.
Oh, wait, let's talk about the mushrooms. The best gag ever in this movie. I love this gag.
Yeah, actually, a couple of gag is probably the best gag in the whole movie.
Because
it's probably true. It goes all the way to the end scene. They do an end scene of this. Okay, before we move into the forest further, we skip on to one of the best gags, rolling gags of this movie, which is the mushrooms playing. Basically, what they're playing is telephone to the guards, and that every mushroom tells what's going on to the next mushroom, and again they get to the guard, but by the time the guard announces it, he's got it wrong, because all these mushrooms have talked to each other but I think it's the best guy, because, and also I think the other guy of the two guards is funny, because the one guard's like, you do it. No, he's like, you do it. They're bad, because I swear, like, one of them thought they were going to get killed. But finally they agree who does it, and they give the news to Bog King that someone has entered the forest.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't know how they were going to go with this at first, but I was hoping for, like, the telephone gag, because I've never seen that done in a movie before. But that was only impressive to me, like, the first time we did it in first grade. Every time tried afterwards, I thought it was just stupid, because people would make up, like, the wrong thing. So I was never impressed with that whole, you know, game, you know, party sort of game. But in the movie, I think it actually works and paid off pretty well. I'm similar to Cheryl in that regard. Because I thought maybe, like, the mushrooms, would be effective at conveying the message. And then, you know, Sunny would, of course, be discovered as a result. Or, like they played it in the film, it would be for a gag and it'd just get lost along the way, which I thought was nice.
Yeah, I agree. And so, yeah, after as Sunny manages to get into the Bog King's castle and get the primrose flower to the Sugar Plum Fairy, who is imprisoned below, the Imp shows him the way. And the Sugar Plum Fairy is, like, captured in, like, a spider web looking deal, and it's like the opposite of the TARDIS. It's smaller on the inside, or she's smaller on the inside. I'm not really sure how that goes. Right? It's like a little tiny thing, and she's inside it, but, like, once she comes out of it, she gets big. And if you put something in it, it gets small.
Yeah, it seemed like some sort of enchantment or something.
He manages to get her the stuff. She makes the love potion, in exchange for Sunny freeing her. And Sunny frees her, but she gets recaptured in their escape attempt. So Sunny gets away. He has the love potion. The Sugar Plum Fairy tells him, don't let the Imp get the love potion, because he just loves to spread that stuff around. But Sunny does manage to get away, does manage to escape, and goes to a party, another ball.
But
apparently,
before he goes to the party, one more gag that's in this movie that I didn't like as much, but I thought again was a gag. It's a gag. The mother presenting suitors for the Bog King.
She was trying hard.
Yeah,
trying to set her son up. That was also that. This is also gonna become a recurring gag, folks.
Yeah, I actually had no idea that was Maya Rudolph until I looked it up.
No. Voice of Aunt Cass from Big Hero 6.
Yeah.
Bit of a connection there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did not appreciate that gag as much as you guys did.
Again, I didn't think it was the best way. I'm not saying as good as the mushrooms. I'm not saying it was good. It was a nice little gag to throw in. It puts in some humor into the dark moments, is what I think they're doing.
I agree. I felt like there was a lot of characters to keep up with, and to add, like, the Bob King's mother to... I understood it the farther we went along in the movie, but, like, to add that, to add the Sugar Plum Fairy, to add... You know what I mean? Like, there was just a lot of people here.
I agree. Had we done maybe had we put in an intro scene in the beginning...
Yeah.
...of... to give us a little bit more history before... Like, when we did the map, we could have done a scene right there to do some of this expedition that we're going to need.
Right.
No. We don't need more opening narration. I disagree there.
I disagree because there we could have put the complaints why the Black King didn't want the love potion.
I agree, because it takes too long for that whole story to get to us.
Yeah.
That shown in flashback somewhere earlier in the movie would have made a tremendous difference.
Yeah. You guys have discussed on the show, you know, it's always best to show, not tell. And, you know, opening narrations can get kind of cumbersome.
Yeah. Well, I didn't say in the beginning, I'm just saying, you know, in general, just the time it takes to get to the stuff about the love potion.
Yeah.
When they've been dropping hints and telling you what's really going on the whole time.
And the payoff, like, it just isn't enough. It isn't enough of a mystery. It's, you know, you can kind of guess pretty early on what's going on, so it's just kind of annoying that they're keeping that from you. Yeah, and just acting like, ooh, it's a big mystery. Why does he hate love? Which is, yeah.
But she doesn't hate love, and that's the whole... point of the movie, so it's just kind of counterproductive.
I'm just trying to help their complaints a little bit by making suggestions that maybe this movie wouldn't have had so many complaints from people like Ryan and Rachel had we done some of this earlier. It's my only thought.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Like, I actually think, like, you could have done it very similarly to Beauty and the Beast, right? Like, they tell the whole story of how the beast became a beast at the very beginning, so you don't have to wonder about that, and we don't have to go back and reveal it later. And I think you could have told the Bog King story, but not told the whole story, very similar to the beast, right? And I think that might have been a way to do it.
Yeah. All right. Can I also mention, I don't know why this is that Alan Cumming always gets cast as a character that nobody wants to fall in love with. Because I was watching Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion this week for the first time, and I had no idea who he was in it. But again, they're playing him as this character that nobody finds attractive. And I don't understand this, because it's Alan Cumming, and he's awesome.
I get it.
I'm team Alan Cumming. I also argue that the Bog King is the best design of the characters, I think.
Yeah, I like the Bog King, for sure.
Well, he reminds me of one of your favorite characters, Ryan, maybe, is Hopper from Bug's Life? Although, we haven't covered that movie yet, but...
I'm not a fan of Hopper.
Okay.
Not a Hopper fan. But yeah, he does look like Hopper, I agree.
Of course, you know, Alan Cumming, one of his best remembered roles is one in which he ultimately suffers the same fate as Anna would have in Frozen, had she not been saved. If you recall GoldenEye, the Bond film, you know, where he goes, "I am invincible," and then proceeds to get cryogenically,
right,
liquid nitrogenized.
And since we're talking about actors really quick, there's one voice person here who does additional voices, which is Kevin Michael Richardson, who's done, like, every character on the planet. So, he's gonna do Groot in Guardians of the Galaxy. He's done a ton of, I believe he's done Star Wars stuff. So, he's done Ultimate Spider-Man voices. So, I consider him our many connections connection.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Great. And so the next big moment of the film is this ball or party, outdoor party, I guess it is, where Dawn is going to be and Sunny is singing on stage and he's supposed to sprinkle her with the love potion there. And what ends up happening instead is the Bog King shows up because he's upset because Sunny has the love potion. And right as Sunny's about to spray the love potion on Dawn, he hits her. But the first person that Dawn sees after the love potion is sprayed is not him. It is the Bog King, so she falls in love with him and starts singing Motown.
Much later, though. I mean, yeah. It's like, you know, it's not at the party that happens.
Yeah, correct, but
I'm
just
saying. They throw her in a sack before she can see anyone.
Yes. But the Bog King basically, like you say, they throw her in a sack and takes her over to the bog side of the forest. And the imp steals the love potion and proceeds to rain chaos upon the forest. And after he steals it, the Bog King says, "You've got to deliver the potion to me by moondown, not sundown, moondown, or I'm going to, in some unspecified way, do harm to Dawn."
Yes, because at dawn, he's going to harm Dawn.
Right. We don't know exactly how, why, or where, but in some way, he's going to do something that is unpleasant with her.
Yep.
That's pretty much as far as it went.
Well, honestly, you feel the whole point of the movie is you feel for him as a character because he's like, it's one of those movies where he's like this highly intelligent guy, right? Or critter in this case, right? But everybody else around him is just driving him nuts and he can't stand it. And the gag's been done a lot of times in movies before, but you know, that's...
He's like self-consciously evil too, which shows you that he can't be like all evil because he knows, you know, he says in the lyrics of one of his songs, you know, "I'm evil." Usually the worst villains, as George Lucas will tell you, don't think that they're bad.
Yeah. I have a question. Did anyone enjoy the character of Sunny? How did you guys feel about Sunny?
I liked him better than I thought I would.
I only liked him because he was like moving. I thought he was the one to help move the plot along because he was like in every scene because he was needed. So much of taking him out would have been helpful to us.
Well, he's like a sidekick, and then he's the hero for a lot of the movie.
Right.
It's really weird.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, there's not a great focus, because like you say, we go on this whole thing of him going to the Bog Kingdom to get the love potion, and you get set up from the beginning that Marianne is really the protagonist, but then she disappears. You know, it's sort of strange in that way.
Yeah, and it's distressing to me that your main romantic interest is someone who at the very beginning, his motivation is, "Hey, I really like you, but I would like you even more if you couldn't turn me down. If you literally could not say no to me because you're under a magic spell."
Well, he doesn't know what her feelings are. I mean,
he should just ask her then.
I agree. He's adult. I thought, I'm not arguing with you with regarding his intellect. I just don't think I don't think he came from a place of bad, like I want to make her love me.
But that's what the potion would have done.
I know, but I think it was the simplest way to get his agenda, was the point for him. I think, like, making this potion was simpler than telling her that he had feelings for her.
He was not a deep thinker.
Yes. So good time on that one.
I don't see him as being heroic because of that, though. I can't get on board, and I can't get on board with him getting with Dawn at the end because of that. I don't really buy it because she never had an interest with him before.
Well, they played along that they were like had been friends for ages.
Yeah,
but like with her like helping her set up with guys and stuff. And as him being the friend. So, I mean, yeah. I got that at the end. But I'm agreeing with you, it's not exactly, like, again, the best choice. But what other choice do we have?
Well, the movie plays, yeah, with this concept of a love potion that we see in A Midsummer Night's Dream. You know, also played with in Shrek 2. But I think, you know, there are panelists here who might not appreciate so much my bestowing added depth to the film, but like the fact that he is an elf and she is a fairy sort of adds an element of, you know, fantasy racism slash classism, where he essentially probably thinks he has, you know, literally zero chance of ending up with Dawn simply because, you know, for that fact alone. And so he just gets, you know, he's driven to the point of desperation, you know, kind of like Roland, and the two of them collaborate and ultimately decide, hey, why not? You know, we have this primrose petal. We can go get a potion made and, you know, let's see how that goes.
Well, someone did point out that all of the African-American voice actors on this film are playing the elves, which are set up to be the kind of lower class citizens. Like, they're not dressed as well, which, again, I'm like, is this a conscious choice or is this something that just sort of happened and they didn't think about it? Like a subconscious thing? I don't really know.
Well, before we get too much into classism, they do have a frog falling in love with a fairy. Let's go with that. Oh, so they have another frog falling in love with the two elves. Interspecies dating.
Yeah, no, it's just played for laughs, essentially.
There's a lot of strange things that are played for laughs, and straight things that are not played for laughs, which is also odd. Like, I felt like the Sugar Plum Fairy was supposed to be a comedic character, for example, and yet she delivers probably the most serious part of the movie when she's talking about the Bog King's, you know, the rationale for why he is the way he is.
Yep.
Well, definitely. So, and also with who's playing it. I mean, like, I would expect Kristen Chenoweth to have a much bigger role than what she did.
Yeah.
That was my comment. That was my big letdown of the movie. Is that, like, it's Kristen Chenoweth, and you have her. I mean, yes, she has a great voice, but she's also a great acting personality because, like, I watched her from West Wing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the way they used her in this movie is, like, she's captured most of it.
I still think it was the right role for her. I mean, certainly she didn't have as much of a presence in this film for it to be a vehicle for her in a similar vein that, you know, Frozen was for Idina Menzel, but I mean, I liked her in the role. She could have used more screen time, for sure.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, her singing was a bright spot for this movie, I will say. She didn't get to sing a whole lot either, which was frustrating.
No, not at all, really.
Yeah, she had the one song when she's making the love potion, and then she sings over the credits.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So, this is the big setup, though. No, back to the plot of the movie. That the Bog King has kidnapped Dawn, and so Marianne flies after her. The King sends Roland and a little army after her, and of course, then Sunny has to go after her. So it's like sort of everybody marching off to war. And then back in the Bog Kingdom, like we mentioned, Dawn gets released from her bag. She sees the Bog King and starts singing Motown because that's what you do when you're in love, apparently. And when Marianne arrives, this was the weirdest part of the movie for me, right? Because Marianne shows up ready to fight, and they get into a fight to Hearts Straight On For You, which I really like that song. I did not really like this version of that song.
Yep.
It, as in, I very much disliked this version of that song, but that's a personal thing because I'm a big fan of Heart. But, like, they fight, and then they just stop fighting and just kind of sit there and chat for a little while. I didn't understand that. Because she sings a song about how she's coming straight on for him, and she's made up her mind, she's going to hurt him, she's going to take back what's hers, which is her sister, and they get done fighting, and they just sort of sit down and have tea.
Well, they both realize they're in a similar predicament, with nothing really they can do until they're able to find an antidote to Dawn's affliction.
Right.
Plus, what's the matter with tea?
Yeah.
It just seems odd to go from trying to stab someone to one lump or two. They start talking to each other and find out that, you know, they have some common things in common, like you were saying, Philip, that, you know, they both want Dawn not to be in love. They need an antidote from the Sugar Plum Fairy. You know, they're both dealing with the fact that they're misunderstood and, you know, all these sorts of things. And when they go to the Sugar Plum Fairy to try and find an antidote, she explains that the only thing that really negates the effect of the potion is true love, and that the reason why the Bog King hates her and her potion is that years ago the Bog King asked her to make a potion, and he gave the potion to somebody and it didn't work, and the reason for that is because she was already in love with someone else. And it's at this point that the Bog King's mother, Griselda, starts seeing that, you know, he's got a thing for Marianne, and it looks like it might be mutual, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, unfortunately, this retelling of the story, though, kind of kills the message of the movie, or the supposed message of the movie, that that everyone deserves love, and that, you know, that, and even Lucas said, he's like, it doesn't matter what you look like on the outside, it's what's on the inside that counts. But again, we have Marianne, who's supposedly our heroine of the movie, like, insulting this woman that the Bog King was in love with, and saying, ew, that's gross, you were in love with her? And this is, like, something that comes back again and again in the movie, where they keep, you know, talking about these other creatures that look different and being like, that's gross. And it's like, well, if your message of the movie is that it doesn't matter what you look like on the outside, but your heroes keep saying this stuff, it completely goes against the whole point of the movie.
Yeah. But considering, you know, his former love interest did look like the creature from Black Lagoon, you probably found it to be a fairly natural reaction.
Yeah, but that's the thing that's frustrating to me, though, is that the Bog King is considered to be this, like, horrendously ugly character. Mm. And they do reference that at points, but all of the women in the movie that find love look like Barbie dolls with wings. Like, it's entirely a one-sided thing in this, that there's a message of, it doesn't matter what you look like on the outside, just so long as you're a guy. But if you're a girl, you'd better look like a Barbie.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
I didn't get that as much, but, you know, I wasn't looking for that, so, you know, it's... I can get where you're going, Rachel, and I agree that, well, because I think part of the problem was that, like the one guard admitted, like, she was a girl to the other guard, and he's like, what? You know, type of thing, and that, you know, I get what Rachel's saying, I can understand that, but I also get that, you know, I didn't think it was that played out.
Yeah, physical beauty is certainly a powerful motivator, you know, especially in marketing and entertainment. So, I mean, that's definitely understandable why they, you know, make that kind of decision, you know, with the designs, and you know, why we see that aesthetic with, you know, the Disney princesses, for example, and Barbies. You know, it's just kind of, yeah, the nature of things.
Yeah. And I think what they were going for was, like, to the point of Lucas making this a thing for girls, is like they were trying to make a princess fairy type of a thing and make it be aspirational. So, of course, you know what I mean? Like, I think that was the idea, but I agreed with you, Rachel. Like, it was sort of strange that the fairies who... The females, of course, are, like you say, are Barbie dolls, and then all the guys are these glass-half-full kind of characters.
I'm just going to go with, again, not all of... I mean, it was very... Because some of the females were animals, it's a very hard to judge.
But not the main characters. Not,
I agree. Yeah. The main characters, yes.
Yeah, the only, I guess, traditionally attractive male of the movie would be your villain, which is Roland, on the guy's side. Otherwise, you have, you know, George Lucas King and the Bog King and Sonny, who's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It was a little strange. So the big confrontation to me felt a lot like the end of Beauty and the Beast. I don't know about you guys, with Roland playing the role of Gaston and marching in to rescue people from the beast, played by the Bog King.
I have a question. Didn't he say you need to bring the love potion to me by moondown, by dawn, or else something will happen? And then he gets upset when they show up with the love potion and says that she has tricked him.
Pretty much, yes.
I think it's because she meant because there was an invading army, not because they didn't show up with the love potion.
Yes, yeah. The army.
Right. I think that's what he was referencing. It's just it's like misplacing a modifier in a sentence, right? It doesn't come across quite well. Here's my biggest problem with what happens next. Okay?
All right.
Roland has never been to this castle before. And he knows exactly how to destroy it and tells his men how to do this before any of them have ever been inside.
I am giving thumbs up on this.
Yeah.
Exactly my point.
One of the more irreconcilable plot holes, I would say, yeah.
Not that it isn't cool when it falls apart or anything. It's very nice. But again, we already established that it's a very pretty movie to look at. It's just, this makes no sense.
Yeah, and it also doesn't make sense why he wants to conquer and have this land that he doesn't even like in the first place and keeps going on about like how ugly it is and stuff.
He just wants war. At the beginning, he tells us he doesn't want war. He just wanted the army. He didn't want her. He just wanted an army.
Yeah. Right,
an army, an excuse to beat stuff up. That was pretty much his whole motivation for life.
Yeah.
But by them... They're coming, so the Bog King thinks Marianne was a distraction so that she set him up, and so even though their little love had started to flourish, this is what's happening. Sunny frees the Sugar Plum Fairy and Dawn, and the Sugar Plum Fairy starts helping to help the people who had gotten hit with the love potion. And it is at the end, after Roland and all the characters and everything, it's the Bog King who actually gets everybody out. Roland falls to his death. I mean, it's very much Beauty and the Beast, the end of that movie. Roland falls to his death, and it's the Bog King who saves everyone. And we have another of our patented fake Disney deaths.
Yep.
Because it seems as though he dies. He does not actually die because Roland sprays Marianne with the love potion. And as it turns out, she starts singing Motown as well, because, again, that's what you do when you're in love. And she punches him instead, and, you know, he ends up dying, falling off the chasm, all these kinds of things. Gets hit by the love potion. He didn't actually die. We find that out at the end, after the credits. But
scene essentially lifted from Shrek 2, by the way, where she fakes she's been affected by the love potion.
Yeah, true. True.
But the twist here was she actually did take the potion, but then we find out later the dynamics of how that potion actually works.
Right, because she's in love with the Bog King, it does not actually work, and they sing Wild Thing to each other.
Right, because the important thing there is the only thing stronger than fake love is real love, because they telegraph that so early in the movie, and then she says there's only one way to beat the potion.
Right.
I like it. It makes sense. But, I thought, you know, the Disney death was simultaneously the most obvious and the most convincing Disney death because, you know, for one thing, you don't actually see, like, where that chasm leads. It didn't seem like it'd be a fatal occurrence. But then you notice how Dawn's eyes suddenly, you know, become shy of the potion, and you think, oh my, he actually must have died because now she's, you know, free of the curse or the, you know, enchantment. But then, yeah, we do learn. And Todd, of course, as you say, was telegraphed throughout the film, so it wasn't too much of a surprise, I guess, that the Bog King did survive ultimately. But I guess I'm definitely a proponent, or I guess an advocate for this film, a defender, if you will, if you've noticed throughout the episode. But I did enjoy it. So I'm not going to be too down on it.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those movies that's going to be that way. Like, you know, I think you've heard Cheryl say the same thing. Like, she really liked it. I think it's one of those that you're either going to really take to or really not. And that's what I thought the movie coming out of it. I thought that, and like I said earlier, that's what the movie is. You know, it was one of those that sort of swung for the fences, and you either are going to connect to it or you're not, you know. And I think you're hearing both sides of that coin, right, in our discussion.
But I'm also agreeing with what you guys are saying, that there are better ways that this could have been done. But again, we're all second quarterbacking here. But,
yeah. Oh, of course, yes. You
know. Well, clearly it was the opinion.
That's what we do here.
Yeah, it was the opinion, I think, of the Disney marketing division that this, rather than being a home run, was ultimately going to be a foul ball, and that's why they, you know, didn't put any effort.
Also, what you're seeing come out of us all here is that we're about 50-50, and if you go to all the review sites that have audience reviews, they're all 50-50 on the audience side.
Right.
Well, do you think Disney should have put more effort in trying to promote this film? And would it have paid off more, do you think? Or
here's how what I think they did is, when it was shown to them 3 years ago, right? Two and a half years ago, it was mostly done at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they have a movie that's mostly done that a lot of people have been working on for a long time. And a lot of people that they just want to free up for other projects, like they want to make an animated Star Wars movie. These people are the people who would be making the animated Star Wars movie, because they are the people who do Clone Wars and Rebels. Okay? So they need to be freed up. And the only way to do that is just to say, okay, we're going to put the movie out now. We're done.
Of course, that fact repudiates the notion that I've seen cropping up on a variety of forums, that this is just some musical Frozen knockoff, you know, coming out in the coattails of that film.
Well, actually, one of the reviews that I read actually made the comment that had it been Lucas that bought Disney, this would have been Frozen.
Yep. I read that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I think at the end of the day, I think that what Todd's saying, there's a lot of validity there, that it's, you know, they were trying to get the people freed up. I think there's also the factor of, if you guys have started seeing the reviews, and some people probably will have seen it by the time this comes out, but of McFarlane, the reviews on that are overwhelmingly positive so far. And we'll talk about that movie, you know, in a little while. But I wonder if Disney didn't sort of look at the two and knowing where they were going to put this movie. I mean, they put the movie out in January. You don't do that if you have faith in the movie.
My one point based going on forward from Todd is, since they had this movie early and had done early, they could have saved themselves from a bad reviews and done like a screening and asked people what they didn't like about it and tried to fix it.
They could have made about the same money had they just done this direct to DVD though. That's the real problem with it.
Yeah. This should, like, I think I would have felt a little bit better about this movie, actually, if it would have been a direct-to-DVD project.
I'm glad they didn't use the Disney label, though. I mean, I don't think under any circumstances it should have been released as, you know, Walt Disney.
Right.
No.
It was under Touchstone. I don't think we mentioned that, but that was the label that they released it under.
Purely a George Lucas passion project.
Yep. No doubt about it. All right. So anything else you guys want to add before we rate the Strange Magic?
I know. I guess one last note. Director of Frozen, Chris Buck, you know, talks about musicals in general and says, you know, how Tangled was, you know, more of a movie with music. And then they were hoping, you know, with Frozen, of course, to make a more traditional musical where the exposition is delivered via music. And, you know, considering this is, like Rachel said, a jukebox film, I like that term. It clearly felt like this was more trying to be that, where it delivers the exposition through singing rather than kind of that start and stop mentality. And I'm sure you guys all feel that you know, it accomplished that to varying degrees of success.
Great.
Well, it's hard for me, and I won't know about the rest of the team, going from something that was, like, we just reviewed a few episodes ago, was this Into the Woods, which did this concept extremely well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To going to this concept where we feel like it needed work. And so, you know, maybe the songs are wrong, era, whatever. But, you know, with some people, I feel the songs were fine. I get that some of the kids might not get the songs. I get that part. But I liked how the songs were done, if the person was dark or if the person was light. I'm using those two aspects. But I do agree that things could have been done better, but again, we're all core backing on everything, like usual.
Yep.
All right, so then let's rate this. Philip, you wanna try this first? Sure. 1 to 5, what'd you think?
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure. I would go with actually a fairly high score, 3.75. I did enjoy this film. I saw it alone the first time, went with a friend the second time. Both times, there were laugh-out-loud moments throughout. I know it just kind of invokes the typical George Lucas kind of wackiness, esoteric nature of films that he has, you know, a lot of creative control over. I mean, the prequels kind of get a bad rap, I know. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Red Letter Media, if you're familiar with them. They do a lot of reviewing and have those famous hour-long Star Wars prequel reviews where they just lambast the films. But I, still being a fan of their work, I find the prequels enjoyable, and you know, George Lucas having a lot of control over those, I still resonate with them. And I think other movies that he has done, you know, Lucasfilm, that maybe get sort of a negative perception, such as Temple of Doom, I still find extremely enjoyable. You know, the second Indiana Jones film, I watched that the night after I watched Strange Magic for the first time and found some pretty cool parallels between the two films. And despite the fact that, you know, there are bizarre elements, there's a lot of wackiness, I just find there's a lot of rich character as well. And I do enjoy the performances. You know, one of the weaker elements, of course, with Strange Magic is the music. I don't really enjoy a lot of the songs personally, but I thought they did a good job of carrying the plot and, you know, telling the story. But, you know, music selection and the renditions of them and so forth weren't always the best. I mean, I liked Marianne as her character, and Evan Rachel Wood did a great job in the role. She's got kind of that Joan Jett, you know, punk rocker vibe to her voice, which I thought was cool. But then again, I didn't really care for a lot of the arrangements that were done on her songs. So, I mean, a little weaker element there. But yeah, I thought the writing was great. You mentioned the screenwriter and how someone from, who's got a history with Disney was responsible for that. And I think they all do such top-notch job on the writing for the Disney animated films in general. And, you know, this definitely seemed to reflect that. So, yeah, those are kind of my thoughts on Strange Magic. I enjoyed it.
We'll go the other direction, I imagine, with this rating. What do you think, Rachel?
Okay, I'm going to give this... I've been going back and forth about it. I'm going to give this 1.75 star. At least 1 star of that is for Alan Cumming, half star for the animation, half star for Chris... maybe quarter, half to quarter star for Kristen Chenoweth, whatever that adds up to. Anyways, my feeling when I was watching this movie, because as I said, I saw this at the movie theater, the Regal in Times Square, and I just kept thinking, you know, I could walk out of this theater and within a few blocks, I could go see Alan Cumming in Cabaret, or I could go see Kristen Chenoweth in On the 20th Century, and I think, honestly, it would have been a better use of my money. Or heck, I could go downtown and see Hamilton down at the Public Theater. Also, great musical. I feel like this was a missed opportunity. There's some talented people here, clearly very talented animators. But I can't give it a higher rating than that. And if you really are curious, I recommend waiting until DVD or streaming to check this out.
Yeah, something tells me this is going to show up on Netflix as part of Disney's deal with them in the very near future, like by summertime. I don't know that for a fact, so don't count on it, but that would be my guess. Yeah, I'm with you, Rachel. I would guess it's like I ended up at around 1.5. Just, you know, I think if you guys were watching my Twitter feed, I went to see this, and I took my daughter with me, and we just turned to each other at the very end, and I said, "That was weird." And she just said, "Yeah, very weird." Like, I just didn't know what to make of it. Other than I did not enjoy my movie going experience. And at the end of the day, that's what I'm looking for when I go to the movies. Is, you know, I like thought-provoking movies. I like, you know, things that make me work for it and try to come to things. But at the end of the day, I need a movie that I enjoy, and I just didn't with this one. So, all right, Cheryl, for a opposite view, what do you think?
2.8, I think, I'm going. I'm one of the people that did like this film a lot. I'm knocking it down a lot because I don't think it's as good as it could have been. I am one of those people that probably will buy it when it comes on DVD. I mean to say that, Todd. But I'm probably buying this when it comes on DVD. Heck, if I'm buying 101 Dalmatians 2, just because I'm getting 101 Dalmatians, I'm going to get this on DVD. I think this is going to be better than 101 Dalmatians 2. But, and I'll look at that way to judge it, because it is animated. And so we've done some animated ones that have been really horrible.
Yeah.
And we've done some animations that were really good, and I think this right fits in the middle. It's not quite a Frozen. It's not quite a Wreck-It Ralph. It's not quite a Big Hero 6. But it's not always. It's not a Mulan 2. It's not, the horrible 2s that we talk about all the time. It's not one of those. So it fits right in the middle for me.
Right. All right, Todd. What about you?
I'm going to be really quick about my rating, but then I have something else I want to say. Basically, I feel it's... I agree with Rachel. 1.75 just feels like the right rating for this movie for me. I've said a lot. Basically, the point I want to get across is why I feel this movie got made the way it did. And that's because everybody thinks they can make a movie. And that's not a bad thing. Everybody should think they can make a movie because everybody deserves to make a lot of money and make a movie, okay? But what I mean by that is when you do that, there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in that a lot of the time, and that's what I see in this movie is I think a lot of these songs were picked and portrayed at points in the movie where they're supposed to portray specific emotions that I don't think they necessarily are portraying because those emotions belong to the person who picked them, which is George Lucas. And that doesn't necessarily translate well. And it just goes back to what I was saying about American Graffiti earlier, where the music picked for that movie carries points where there's no dialogue to help tell the story, not bring about emotion and tell the story, which is what's trying to do here. So that's – I'm just trying to say I can see how this movie got made the way it did because of that.
Great. All right. Well, there you go. A wide range of opinions on Strange Magic, so make your own decisions accordingly. I forewarn you that you may or may not enjoy it. My guess is by the time you hear this, you will not have the option of seeing it in the theaters because it will probably be gone by then. But when Cheryl said, if it's coming out, or Rachel said, if it's coming out, DVD, Netflix, etc., choose wisely.
Much more worth a rent than a theater ticket, yeah.
Yeah. Philip, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was an immense pleasure. I was looking for this extremely with extreme anticipation, I should say. So thank you so much. I really love Disney Film Project podcast, so there's my rousing endorsement for you guys.
Well, we appreciate it. All right. And make sure they go and check out your podcast. Do you want to throw another plug?
Oh, yep. Genre Savvy Podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, genresavvy.com. We're named after the TV trope, Genre Savvy. It's kind of about how, if you're an ironic character within a film or a, piece of entertainment who kind of knows they're in a story, but not really, we like to be very meta on the show. So, that's kind of where that comes from. And then we cover all forms of media and genres. We have a lot of fun. So listen to Genre Set.
Cool. And as we mentioned often here, you can also find this show on iTunes or on Stitcher or also on Diz Dad's Radio here. So if you want to go check out the various places you can listen to this show, you can also find Philip's show. So there you go. All right, so that will do it for this week's episode. I mentioned the places that you can listen to the show, so we will wrap things up then. For our guest Philip, for Rachel, for Todd, and for Cheryl, I'm Ryan, and we'll see you again soon.
Execute plan on my code word, go.
Give me the potion by Moondown, or you'll never see your sister again.
Oh my boggy woggy kingy wingy.
Oh no, not a princess. Well, at least you don't sing.
I don't know. I was expecting more.